AI PCs built for business with Intel Core Ultra processors and Intel vPro are optimized for hundreds of AI apps and tools to boost user productivity, collaboration, and creativity. No product can be absolutely secure. Learn more at intel.com/ITheroes.
Israel reels after the passage of a historic judicial reform bill. Plus, China signals support for its struggling property sector, and family SUVs are finally going electric.
If you're going to sort of break through to the mainstream and get beyond the early adopters who are interested in the technology or a cool brand name, you've got to have stuff in this category that fits people's day-to-day lives, shuttling kids to and from soccer practice, that kind of thing.
It's Tuesday, July 25th. I'm Luke Vargas for the Wall Street Journal, and here is the AM edition of What's News, the top headlines and business stories moving your world today. Doctors and medical workers in Israel have gone on strike this morning in protest against yesterday's passage of a controversial judicial overhaul. Monday's legislation was an amendment to one of Israel's so-called basic laws and effectively removes the Supreme Court's ability to nullify certain government decisions. The medical association says the new law removes the judicial scrutiny over the political leadership of the health ministry, echoing similar concerns by the Israel Bar Association and opposition politicians who have petitioned Israel's Supreme Court to strike it down. The court has never struck down a basic law before, and if it decides to hear the petitions, it could put the court in direct conflict with the country's government. Shares of Chinese property developers jumped in trading today after top officials said that Beijing would provide further support for the struggling real estate sector. Home sales and home prices have fallen in recent months after a brief uptick earlier in the year in what has become the latest challenge to the world's second largest economy. At a meeting Monday, China's Politburo acknowledged that and other headwinds, a move that our Asia markets editor Matthew Thomas told me was enough to buoy sentiment.
This was not a decisive statement of stimulus from the central government. But a lot of analysts and economists expected to be disappointed by the minutes of the Politburo meeting. And they were much less disappointed than they expected. So we've had this market rally. One of the key things that came out of this was the removal of a slogan, housing is for living, not for speculation. That was included in previous minutes of these meetings, and it signaled that for the last 2 years, China's government has kind of felt that the boom in the property sector went too far, and they were trying to cool the sector. That's an acknowledgement that perhaps they went a little bit too far in trying to cool it, and they need to allow some wealth generation in the sector again.
U.S. regulators have scolded banks for manipulating their deposit data. On Monday, the Federal Deposit Insurance Corporation, or FDIC, warned U.S. lenders not to take liberties with their deposit numbers following this spring's banking crisis. Finance reporter Patricia Kausman says a journal investigation of bank filings with the FDIC found that 47 banks had restated the share of their deposits that were uninsured by nearly $200 billion in the wake of March's collapse of Silicon Valley Bank.
The FDIC is the entity that effectively provides the insurance, which typically covers up to $250,000 in deposits. So, of course, it needs to keep a close track on how much of uninsured deposits are out there. In addition, the FDIC also said that it was planning to charge banks with large amounts of uninsured deposits to basically help replenish this government insurance fund that was tapped when the banks failed in March. So right now it's looking at banks' uninsured deposits to make this calculation of actually how much they're going to charge banks. Of course, for the bank, the less you have on those uninsured deposits, the less you will pay.
Coming up a quarter century into the EV revolution, where are the electric versions of family-sized SUVs? Our look at why EV makers have largely avoided the category to date and why that could soon change after the break.
The The Claude 3 model family from Anthropic is your one-stop shop for enterprise AI. With models at every point on the price-performance curve, you no longer have to make trade-offs between intelligence, speed, and cost. Claude 3 Opus sets new industry benchmarks for intelligence. Sonnet strikes the perfect balance between skills and speed. And Haiku is the fastest and lowest-cost model on the market, perfectly designed for high-volume, high-speed use cases. Join the thousands of enterprises who trust Anthropic to keep them at the frontier. Visit anthropic.com/Claude today.
Large SUVs are the car of choice for American families, and yet that same demographic has largely bypassed electric vehicles because of a lack of cargo space and a third row of seats among available EV models. But according to Journal Auto's reporter Mike Colias in Detroit, that could soon change. And Mike joins me now with the details on that. Mike, before we look at what's going to be rolling off the assembly line in the next few months in this large SUV category, just tell us what the market currently looks like. I'm trying to think of a large SUV that's an EV out there. Not many are coming to mind.
Yeah, that's because there's almost none right now. There's a large Mercedes and EQS that I believe has an optional third row, and that's over $100,000. Rivian's SUV came out, the R1S, and that's also 80,000 plus. And that may be, there's a big Hummer SUV, but that's only two row. It's a category that the car companies, you know, it's not that it's not important. I think they've just had other priorities. And up until now, we just haven't seen many, but there's several in the works.
Rivian, Hummer, Mercedes, I'm waiting to hear Kias and Fords. Are we gonna, what's coming out in the next few months?
Yeah, that's the thing. There's nothing in the mainstream brands, but we're going to see a Kia. It's their EV9 by the end of the year. They're saying in the fourth quarter. They showed it at the New York Auto Show. Volvo should be early 2024, an EX90, and Volvo's been very aggressive with its EV rollouts, and so now it's time for a large seven-seater. And then a number of the mainstream brands have talked about having things in the works. Toyota, Ford, I know Cadillac's got something going at GM and probably other GM seven-seaters too. So yeah, in the next, call it 6 to 18 months, I think we're going to see a good handful of these hit the market.
At a price point that's more palatable than the ones you named earlier?
Yeah, so you know, the companies are usually pretty coy about giving us pricing before they come out, but most people are expecting this Kia to be in the $60,000 range. That's a lot of money. It's also not a whole lot more than what you'd expect to pay for a gas-powered version of the same size car.
And yet, Mike, it has been more than 25 years since the first mass-produced hybrid car, the Prius from Toyota, hit the market and kicked off the sort of surge in EV sales that we've seen in recent years. So why haven't automakers produced large electric SUVs before?
The focus has been on large sedans, luxury stuff. And then among the mainstream brands like Ford, GM, Volkswagen, it's really been this sort of compact to midsize SUV, the Tesla Model Y fighter that every company's been trying to combat. And so the reason for that is that's the biggest market size-wise in the U.S. auto industry. And so they needed to cover that base first. But now this is kind of the most logical next step, because the second largest category are these large three-row SUVs. It's been a fast-growing part of the market for the last several years. It's kind of become that sort of family hauler. So this is an opportunity. Those small to mid-size SUVs really have attracted early adopters, people who are tech forward, just interested in the innovation, tends to tilt heavily male. Kia's EV6, which is a mid-size SUV, it's 75% male is their customer base. And so they feel like this EV9, it's a family vehicle. They think they can get 50-50 men and women buyers for that vehicle. They're going after a different breed of buyers and opening that up to the EV world.
All right, so some sensing of opportunity here, and yet I imagine there are challenges too. If we're going to refer to these cars as gas guzzlers, they've got to be electric guzzlers as well, right? Is that presenting a challenge?
That's kind of the rub with this. They're more likely to be taken for long trips than other types of vehicles, and so the range becomes a real issue. And that's the one thing that EV ownership, if you're in a major urban city and you've got charging at home, you're in pretty good shape for most of the stuff you do. But when you go on a road trip, even if you get 300 or 400 miles of range, it's a logistical challenge. You've got to figure out where you're going to charge, make sure there's chargers there. You've got to bake in extra time to charge the vehicle because it takes a lot longer than just filling up at the gas station. So I think anyone who's buying one of these as a family vehicle, going to go on road trips, there's questions that you have to answer for yourself.
All right, so some big questions swirling for potential buyers here. What is at stake for automakers and for this growing EV trend as the industry tries to push into large SUVs?
Well, right now, given what's on the market today, the industry's limited itself with the number of people they can reach. If you're going to sort of break through to the mainstream and get beyond sort of the early adopters who are interested in the technology or a cool brand name, you've got to have stuff in this category that fits people's sort of day-to-day lives, shuttling kids to and from soccer practice, that kind of thing.
That was Wall Street Journal Autos reporter Mike Colias in Detroit. Mike, thanks so much.
You bet. Thanks for having me on.
It is another busy earnings day with Unilever kicking things off this morning with a beat on its second quarter sales growth as price increases outweighed a slight decline in volumes. The Anglo-Dutch retailer, which owns consumer brands like Ben & Jerry's ice cream, Dove soap, and Hellmann's mayonnaise, also raised its full-year guidance. Journal reporter Sabra Chowdhury spoke to us shortly after Unilever's earnings call, on which the company's CFO reflected on the state of consumer spending.
It's very dependent region by region. China, for instance, is looking very different to what's going on in the US. He did flag Europe as being a really, really tough environment for them. The European consumer is just very stretched. He sort of kept emphasizing that. But globally, overall, it sounds like he thinks they're past this point of peak inflation. That doesn't mean prices are all just going to come crashing down. Prices will continue to stay high. We should see things start moderating. And you're seeing that in the numbers sort of coming out of the US and the UK, where inflation has started to come down. The big question everyone's been asking is, how sustainable is this? What he's indicated is we will see more of pricing starting to come down.
Meanwhile, Gen Z and international listeners have propelled Spotify to achieve its strongest ever quarter for user growth, as paying subscribers rose by 17% to 220 million. The streaming giant is reporting an 11% jump in revenues, though losses are also widening amid cuts to its podcasting division and increased music royalty costs. To boost profitability, Spotify is raising subscription prices in the United States and plans to do the same in other markets. And we should note that News Corp's Dow Jones & Co., publisher of the Wall Street Journal, has a content partnership with Spotify's Gimlet Media Unit. And we will have more earnings from the likes of GM, Alphabet, Microsoft, Snap, and Visa later today. This is as the Fed begins its two-day meeting to discuss monetary policy, with markets also closely watching data from the U.S. Consumer Confidence Index, which is due out later this morning. The U.S. Senate Finance Committee has published its investigation into former Apollo Global Management CEO Leon Black and his relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. Journal reporter Richard Rubin says the investigation also looks at whether Black had trust arrangements that improperly moved assets out of his estate.
It's an investigation that's been going on for more than a year now as part of the committee's look at how high-income people and high-wealth people try to avoid taxes. And they've been looking at a series of transactions that Mr. Black did while he was advised by Jeffrey Epstein. In particular, they're looking at what he was paying Jeffrey Epstein, $158 million over 2012 to 2017, like what that was for. Epstein was not an accountant or a tax lawyer, but he was clearly offering some sort of advice for that, and that was beyond what he was paying other people. And that's an issue potentially for Leon Black's taxes to the extent that the money he was giving to Jeffrey Epstein was a gift as opposed to just a payment for services.
A spokesman for Black said he has fully paid all taxes and defended the transactions related to Epstein as legal and vetted by law firms and other advisors. And House Speaker Kevin McCarthy is set to face a new test on Capitol Hill this week as he aims to get 2 of 12 spending bills through the chamber in the coming days. Fiscal conservatives are flashing warning signs that they could delay or derail McCarthy's plans, arguing that they rely on sleight-of-hand budgeting in order to show budget reductions, but ultimately won't change the trajectory of future spending. The hard-right Freedom Caucus, whose members have signaled a willingness to vote against the spending bills, is due to hold a press conference today. Any obstruction in passing the appropriations bills could help lead to a partial government shutdown in October if no spending deal or short-term extension passes the GOP-controlled House and Democratic-controlled Senate. And finally, so-called forever chemicals, or PFAS, are seemingly everywhere. They're used on our clothes to promote water resistance and repel stains, and on our frying pans to make them non-stick. But some of the things that make forever chemicals so effective also means that they stay in our bodies for years, and they're now being linked to health issues, including high cholesterol and an increased risk of kidney cancer. Amanda Cattermole is a consultant who helps companies come up with strategies to make their products safer and more environmentally friendly, and she told our Future of Everything podcast why the hunt for PFAS alternatives is leaving brands with tough decisions.
So an alternative could be wax, right? So if you think about wax, you know that it repels water. It would be treated a little bit different to be applicable to a textile because you would want it not to feel waxy. Ideally, you want the performance to be as good as the PFAS, which is really difficult to do. How good does it need to be? Do we need to be perfect? Or are we okay actually having a lower level of performance? And so it was really looking at lowering consumer expectations, knowing that the performance was never going to be as good as with PFAS.
And you can hear much more about the clothing industry's challenges in moving away from PFAS on our podcast, The Future of Everything. And that's What's News for Tuesday morning. We'll be back tonight with a new show. I'm Luke Vargas for The Wall Street Journal. Thanks for listening.
Zscaler extended its zero-trust architecture with powerful AI engines trained by 500 trillion daily signals to prevent ransomware and AI attacks that target business. Zscaler Zero Trust plus AI. Learn more at zscaler.com/zerotrustAI.